Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. My name is Keith Bradshaw. I'm the Hong Kong Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and I'll be your host this evening on behalf of the Foreign Correspondents Club Professional Committee. Before we get started, just a couple of housekeeping notes. Some of you probably have heard them dozens of times, but please, everybody, pull out your phones now, mute them at least, or turn them off entirely. Mike and I just did so. We hope all of you will. We do put the video, not the video that he's going to show us, but the video of the Q&A, for example, on the web, and it's great when people can properly hear the questions and don't have an interrupting buzz during it. With that, we have two events coming up that might interest you. First of all, on the 25th, we have two speakers debating, Kevin Egan and Jay Ma, debating whether Hong Kong's legal system is any better than the mainland's. And that's on the 25th. We still have seats available for that. And then on the 27th, we have actually the most senior Chinese PRC official that we've had in years, and that will be the head of the Development and Reform Commission of Guangdong Province. So that is the top economic planner of Guangdong Province. Not every day we get a Chinese official taking Q&A from us here. So we're looking forward to that. And he'll be speaking on China's 21st century maritime Silk Road. That's Wednesday of next week. We still have seats for that as well. With that, let me introduce, if I need to, Mike Chinoy. There's probably no one who's spoken here as many times over the last few years as Mike. We always enjoy it. His series on American foreign correspondence in China has been just terrific. As you know, he is a senior fellow at the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California. He is selling DVDs of his Tiananmen Square installment of this series, as well as the installment you're going to see tonight. They are DVDs that he burned on a computer, so they will work, or should work, absolutely will work on a computer, but not necessarily on a DVD player. They're designed, the DVDs at the front there are designed to be played on a computer. But if any of you want to get them, this is a project gathering information on foreign correspondence that has to encounter the hurdle that the networks charge an arm and a leg for every second of time that you try to buy from their archives for this kind of a documentary. And so he's selling those DVDs at the front partly to be able to get more seconds of network time for the future installments. With that, I'd like to introduce Mike, who will say just a couple words about the documentary, and then after the documentary is over, he'll take your questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Keith. I'm delighted to be back here. This film looks at the experience of American correspondents covering China in the 1970s. And so it has a special resonance for me because I began my career as a sort of fledgling China watcher showing up in Hong Kong in late 1975. So some of the events that are central to this film are events that I covered, and I have vivid memories of going with great trepidation to the old Foreign Correspondents Club over where the Hong Kong Club is now and watching these legendary figures who I found extremely intimidating holding court at the bar telling war stories and so on. So it's very special for me to be able to come back here and share this with you. Let me ask, how many of you have seen other episodes of this series? Raise your hand. Okay, so most of you know what this is about. The 30-second soundbite version for those of you for whom this is new is that this is a multi-part series we're doing at the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California on the history of American journalists in China from the 1940s to the present day, basically trying to tell the story of the people who have told the China story, because our feeling is that the way the U.S. press has covered China over many decades has been hugely important in shaping popular perceptions of China in the States and around the world, but most people don't have the slightest idea how the correspondents who did that job actually reported the country. What was involved, for example, in covering the death of Chairman Mao when you couldn't get into China to do it and you had to sit here, which is one of the issues that's explored in this film. So we began this process of tracking down old China hands from various quarters and collecting all this amazing old footage, and we're telling their story. We've got 7 of the Plan 10 episodes done up to the through Tiananmen Square. Eventually, we'll bring the story up to the present day. The episodes are also available on our website, china.usc.edu, and they're primarily designed for educational use in China education and China studies and journalism education programs in colleges and universities, but done in such a way as to be accessible to the public at large, which is to say people like yourselves. I don't know how many, are there anybody who was in Hong Kong in the 1970s here? All right. Anybody who worked as a journalist in Hong Kong in the 1970s here? I guess I'm the only one. So, but anyway, one of the things that's interesting about this film is it's the evocation of Hong Kong and the experience of journalists at that time. So with that, why don't we turn the lights off? And the film lasts just under an hour, and that should leave us plenty of time for discussion afterwards.
Interwoven with every activity is the common thread of Mao Zedong thought.
During President Richard Nixon's visit in 1972, American journalists had gotten a tantalizing glimpse of China. But after Nixon's departure, the power struggle between moderates like Premier Zhou Enlai and radical ideologues led by Chairman Mao's wife, Zhang Qing, who became known as the Gang of Four, intensified. U.S. reporters were again stuck on the outside, forced to watch China from Hong Kong. Steve Bell was ABC's Hong Kong correspondent from 1972 to 74.
All you could do when you were a so-called China watcher in Hong Kong was to get these very broken up TV broadcasts from what was then Canton TV.
Bruce Dunning was then a correspondent in Asia for CBS.
The images were terrible. They were black and white and in terrible condition, but usually that was all the picture we had out of China.
It was like a Ouija board. You were always searching for a reality, and there were a lot of conflicting signals.
In those years, only one North American news organization was allowed to station a correspondent in Beijing, Canada's leading paper, the Toronto Globe and Mail. From 1971 to 75, its reporter was Englishman John Burns.
When I was the Globe and Mail correspondent, I was also de facto the New York Times correspondent, because having no correspondent, there was a syndication agreement. Mm-hmm. So from the get-go, from the moment I landed in China, mm-hmm. I was, if there was something about the goings-on in mainland China mm-hmm. in the New York Times, it was going to appear under my byline.
Although based in the Chinese capital, Burns, too, struggled to put the pieces of the China puzzle together.
If the story is a 2,500-piece jigsaw, you will only have, at best, probably a few hundred pieces of that jigsaw.
Meanwhile, in the spring of 1973, the U.S. opened a liaison office in Beijing. Soon after came invitations for the three American TV networks to send crews to China. Irv Drasnin was a producer for CBS News.
It was filmed in 2 months during the summer of 1973. That is the longest stay any American observer has been permitted in this city that was once dominated by foreigners.
This is the first time they have let American television journalists come to China except to cover Nixon's visit. They let each of the networks in to make a documentary, one documentary.
In 1972, at the time of the Nixon visit, Drasnin, who'd studied Chinese at Harvard, had produced a controversial documentary called Misunderstanding China, narrated by Charles Kuralt.
No ticky, no washy. One from column A and one from column B and a fortune cookie. You'll be hungry an hour later.
And
That is about as much as we know about the Chinese.
My original title for Misunderstanding China was The Yellow Peril and Other Things We Think We Know About China. Cooler heads prevailed and it became Misunderstanding China, which worked perfectly because into each commercial break during the broadcast, the announcer would say, Misunderstanding China will continue after this message, which is certainly true.
Genghis Khan leads the East against the world!
The film was an exploration of popular American attitudes and stereotypes of China.
The history of our attitudes toward China. And that's what we're going to talk about during the rest of this broadcast. This is a funny story and a dismaying one, and not a trivial story either. As you will see, the history of attitudes has a lot to do with the history of events. What we think about something naturally influences what we do about it.
It was a frightening idea for Americans. The yellow peril had merged with the red peril. The point here is not history. The point is how fast our thinking changed.
The GIs battle the new elements with everything they have.
Now, in the wake of the Nixon visit, American attitudes, shaped by the media, were shifting again.
If you ever want to see the influence of the media, just look at American China relations between 72 and 73. I think the 72 Nixon trip was pure television, and it had an enormous impact on Americans. In a way, it went from being mindless hordes coming over snow-capped mountains in Korea, killing Americans with no fear of death, to almost a warm, cuddly picture of Chinese civilians and the Chinese people in general. It was a huge shift.
Yet the gulf between Americans and Chinese remained enormous, as Drasden and his team discovered while shooting their documentary, A Look at the City of Shanghai, in 1973.
We were the curiosities in China. I mean, here are these Americans. They just weren't foreigners, they were Americans with their camera crew. And one of these Americans had hair down to his shoulders. We would go out on the street and we would be surrounded. We would be surrounded, the equipment would be surrounded. People would just press in on us. They wanted to get a look at us. We literally couldn't move.
CBS reports, Shanghai.
After 2 months in China, Drasden's documentary on Shanghai offered a more nuanced picture of China than most Americans had seen.
All parents everywhere have hopes and dreams for their children. What hopes and dreams do you have for your son?
We do have hopes for him. I wish he could become an actor, because I myself worked in the field of literature and art, so it might influence him.
As the CBS team left, ABC News correspondents Ted Koppel and Steve Bell arrived for a 10-week stay.
What we proposed was that we would try to find sort of different categories of people. So we had the military category, we had the student category, we had the worker-peasant category, which of course is how the Chinese themselves during the Cultural Revolution, everybody was a worker-peasant, soldier-peasant, you know, whatever the hell it was, it was always this hyphenated kind of person.
Interwoven with every activity is the common thread of Mao Zedong thought.
Like Drasden's CBS crew, Koppel and Bell found themselves tightly controlled.
It wasn't bad, but we were very carefully watched at all times. They had pre-selected the people that we would be allowed to talk to and interview.
Although the chaos of the Cultural Revolution had subsided, relentless ideological indoctrination still dominated Chinese life.
Every one of the students in 1973 spoke pure Mao speak without any effort whatsoever. It really was the way they had to talk to each other.
The most sort of shattering image was of the relationship between they let us go into an English class at the university. The relationship between the students and the professor. The professor was a woman, I would guesstimate, in her late 30s, early 40s. And she was clearly terrified of her students.
Does it make it more difficult for you as a teacher to know that if you make mistakes, your students will severely criticize you?
Sometimes I felt ashamed and would blush. And I felt that I had lost my faith at the very beginning. But gradually, I found that the students criticized me only for the sake of helping me.
And then we came back about a month or 6 weeks later, and they were all out participating in the cotton harvest. And there was the teacher, and I stopped to ask her, you know, isn't this sort of, I mean, don't you feel a little bit awkward doing this? You're an academic, you're an intellectual.
Do you really feel you have a good identification now with the lower middle peasants?
I can hardly say. I think I'm doing my best to learn from the workers and the peasants.
She was scared out of her mind.
32 years later, Steve Bell went back to China and found three of the students he and Koppel had interviewed in 1973, as well as the teacher.
She told me that she came from a prominent pre-revolutionary family that had been accused of bourgeois ideas during the Cultural Revolution, and she was extremely fearful as a teacher, and she said, we would wake up every morning and I would look out the window to see if there were posters criticizing me. And I was scared to death.
Everything you said, you had to think about it first. Otherwise, you'd be criticized and the consequences would be very serious. Not only yourself, but your family.
The former students said, we were so naive. We had no idea what was really going on.
A lot of political pressure. I mean, what do you think? I mean, all the textbooks are quotations.
I then did an interview with all of them together, and she retold that story, and they were completely flabbergasted. And when the interview ended, the young woman who had been a student, who was sitting right next to her, put her hand on the teacher's knee and said, we are so sorry. We didn't know. We are so sorry. The first thing I did was turn to make sure the cameraman was still rolling, because that was the moment, the most enlightening moment that I've ever had in China.
The ABC documentary aired in December 1973, but the program infuriated the radicals in the Chinese leadership. Koppel and Bell's interpreter, Li Dan, paid the price.
I remember some of the music we used was a bit ominous, and there were pictures of Mao with this ominous music as we tried to put the Cultural Revolution into perspective. And that was heavily criticized by the Gang of Four, and that's what led our interpreter, Li Dan, to be sent to the re-education camp.
It was more than a year before Li Dan was freed. In that year, the power struggle within the leadership intensified. As the only reporter for a North American news organization in Beijing, the Toronto Globe and Mail's John Burns got the occasional glimpse.
You could go to the airport, for example, for heads of state arrivals. And the Politburo would turn out if it was an important head of state, and there were slightly curious figures like Haile Selassie, the Emperor of Ethiopia, I recall, who you might not think would be in the on the A-list of visiting heads of state, but was very important to China because he was a bridge to Africa. And the whole Politburo would be there, but it was visibly divided. Then there were two groups. There was the Gang of Four, the four, Jiang Jing, and the other three. Then there was the other group, most of them much more venerated in the history of the Communist Party, older men. And between them, there would be somebody commuting physically on the airport apron, and the person commuting between the two was Joe and I. You didn't have to be a sinologist of 50 years standing to understand what was going on there.
Henry Bradshaw was then the Hong Kong correspondent for the now defunct Washington Star.
I, by that time, was writing it very hard and saying that there was definitely a new split within the government. There was contention in the government, there was disagreement, there was a fight going on. And I wrote that day-to-day in newspaper reports.
With normalization talks between the U.S. and China deadlocked over the issue of American support for Taiwan, Henry Kissinger, in particular, was upset with articles reporting discord within the Chinese leadership.
Kissinger, on a couple of occasions, tried to keep my editors from publishing some of my articles. He'd call up the editor of the Washington Star and say, hey, you don't want to really publish this. This isn't right. Kissinger was, you know, didn't want anybody looking like his policy was maybe wrong, that or was a misunderstanding of what was really happening in China.
In Beijing, too, there was anger at Bradshaw's reporting.
After I'd written writing these articles very hard in the spring of 74, a couple of non-American journalists in Beijing who visited Beijing, a BBC man, and I forget who the other one represented, in the foreign ministry in Beijing were told that everything's fine here, you know, unity, peaceful, and the Hong Kong journalists are a despicable bunch, and Bradshaw is the most despicable of them all. You know, he's seeing things that aren't there. Sent down the word. Bradshaw is the most despicable of them all, and he will never be allowed to visit China again. That was the direct message I got from two different channels.
John Burns repeatedly got the message directly from angry Chinese officials.
I got used to telephone calls at 3, 4 in the morning from a distant and very chilly voice saying, you will be in the foreign ministry 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and I would drive down through utterly deserted streets and park my Volkswagen Beetle in the compound, the foreign ministry compound, and go to an empty room, empty save for a portion of Mao, sometimes wait for several hours alone, one wooden chair, and in would come the reproving officers of the state, very often from the information department of the foreign ministry, which was very closely allied with Chinese security. And the address shouted at me by somebody in a Mao suit, with a shrill voice, was almost always the same. You have insulted the leadership of the People's Republic of China. You have abused the hospitality of the people of the People's Republic of China. And these are most grave matters. Do you have anything to say?
Richard Bernstein, who'd studied Chinese at Harvard, was then writing about China for Time magazine from New York.
We understood that there was a power struggle, which the Chinese propaganda machine vigorously denied all those years and denounced all this Western reporting that talked about divisions in the leadership and stuff like that, when in fact there was an absolute vicious power struggle going on.
Bernard Kalb had been a longtime Asia correspondent for CBS.
I think altogether you'd have to say there was a sophisticated skepticism on the part of the media about how to report China.
Joseph Lelyveld became the New York Times Hong Kong correspondent in 1973, expecting to go to China.
I sort of figured China would be open because Nixon had gone, and after the election China would open, right? But it didn't. So that's how I wound up in Hong Kong as a China watcher.
Stuck in the British colony, Lelyveld relied heavily on sources at the U.S. consulate. Raymond Burkhardt served at the consulate in the mid-70s.
We had a Chinese employee named Vincent Low, who was famous because he and some of his colleagues who were in the China watching business could look at a photograph and could tell you immediately, or look at a list of from people who were named to the Central Committee, and they would tell you, oh, well, this guy served in the Third Field Army with him, so of course he's there, you know. And The location of those two people in the photographs reflects the fact that they were together in 1928 in Hunan, you know, and they were right, you know. This stuff tended to bear out in terms of who was up and down and how people related to each other.
Vincent and I would meet about twice a week for lunch in the Clipper Lounge of the Mandarin Hotel. I'd have to walk 2 blocks to the Clipper Lounge and walk 2 blocks back to my office. It was quite enjoyable because I liked him, I liked his mind, I liked the game. I had expected to hate China watching, and it turned out I didn't, because there were little mysteries you could get into, like whatever happened to Lin Biao.
There was only one place in Hong Kong where foreigners, including journalists, could occasionally interact with Chinese officials, a social event run by Percy Chen, a well-connected pro-Beijing lawyer.
There were also these odd gatherings that were organized by a guy named Percy Chen called the Marco Polo Club, which had a lot of sort of PRC types resident in Hong Kong. People from the Bank of China, the New China News Agency, Xinhua. Many of them were, intelligence officers. And that was the way sort of foreigners and the Chinese interacted in Hong Kong.
In Beijing, John Burns struggled to make his own connections with ordinary Chinese.
The tale most often told about covering China at that point during the Cultural Revolution was how restricted we were. But I discovered the bicycle. I could go out in the evening and cycle either down the hutongs, the old alleyways of the city, or out into the countryside to a village. It was also accessible to somebody who, in those days, in my case, was a runner. And I started running early in the morning and late at night, and I learned an extraordinary amount of things, because there would be others running at night, Chinese, and everywhere in the world there's a great fraternity amongst runners, and you could team up with somebody and run for an hour and learn a lot about the town, about the city, but about the society as well, because there's this basic sense of trust.
Sometimes Burns' daily runs through the capital provided chilling insights.
I can remember running early one morning. It wasn't the only time, past the State Security Ministry's offices, headquarters, and hearing volleys of gunfire. And I was sure I was listening to executions. 6 o'clock in the morning, just a volley, sometimes followed by a single pistol shot. When Mao himself died and we began to learn the truth, of course, it turned out to be exactly that, that they were executing people.
In August 1974, Richard Nixon had been forced to resign because of the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford became president. Ford retained Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State, and in November, Kissinger flew to Beijing. Rebuffed in all previous China visa requests, Joseph Lelyveld managed to switch places with the New York Times State Department correspondent when Kissinger's plane refueled in Tokyo.
When he got to Tokyo, we'd arranged for Bernie Grossman, who was the State Department correspondent, to get off the plane, and I got on the plane as the faux State Department correspondent of the New York Times, and we'd outmaneuvered them. They couldn't do anything about it without stopping Kissinger, because it was Kissinger's plane. And the Americans had agreed to it, so they had my passport, and I went in with the whole bunch.
But with Zhou Enlai suffering from cancer, Kissinger made only a courtesy call on Zhou at the hospital, and the two sides still at odds over U.S. support for Taiwan, American hopes of a diplomatic breakthrough did not materialize.
Zhou Enlai did not appear. He was visited in the hospital where he had a very showy bandage around his head, as if he had just had brain surgery or something. And Deng Xiaoping appeared out of nowhere. And took his place at the Great Hall of the People on the first night. That was pretty dramatic.
And Deng, to whom Zhou Enlai had given day-to-day responsibility for foreign affairs, was blunt and tough. He criticized Kissinger for pursuing détente with the Soviet Union and failing to deliver on promises to break relations with Taiwan. The only concrete result of the Kissinger trip was an invitation for President Ford to visit the following year. In the spring of 1975, Orville Schell, a young Harvard-trained sinologist, got on a trip to China with a group of 20 American left-wing activists. Schell, though, was writing for The New Yorker.
Zhou Enlai at that point was trying to kind of affect some, put some real muscle tissue on the U.S.-China relations. So he asked a friend of mine to organize a youth work delegation. And I went as a youth worker, but in fact I was writing for The New Yorker.
Shell hadn't told the Chinese he was a writer. When they found out, there was trouble.
When they learned I was writing for The New Yorker, this created an immense amount of static. And at one point, when we were working at Dajai, the model agricultural brigade in Shaanxi province, they became so exercised about the fact that I was a writer that I remember there was a reason, but it wasn't a very profound reason. They told me that I wasn't feeling well and that I would be spending a few days in my cave. We all lived in caves in the Shaanxi Lus Hills. And it was pretty disconcerting, but it was my first intimation of what it was like, or could be like, in China to run afoul of the man and to be, in this very mysterious way, for crimes you're not quite sure what they are, you've committed, you were ostracized. And then finally, a few days later, they decided, well, they'd have to let me out.
Shell was part of a new generation of China reporters that emerged in the mid-1970s. Most of them were based in Hong Kong. Fox Butterfield, who'd also studied Chinese at Harvard, took over the New York Times Hong Kong bureau from a frustrated Joseph Lelyveld.
At first, I was filled with trepidation. I mean, I was almost scared the first few months when I was writing these stories, like, this is going to blow up in my face, and I'm going to be completely wrong, because we are speculating based on, you know, a few people's understanding of what's going on, and we're hypothesizing, and we're not able to go there, we're not able to see it, we're not able to touch it, we're not able to do what reporters normally do.
Richard Bernstein moved to the British colony for time. A young couple, both also educated at Harvard, Jay and Linda Matthews, arrived as well. She was working for the newly established Asian edition of the Wall Street Journal, he for the Washington Post, following in the footsteps of the Post's veteran Asia correspondent Stanley Carno, a goal Matthews had had since college.
By the time I was 19 years old, sitting in Cambridge, Massachusetts, beginning to read the Washington Post for the first time, I knew I wanted to be the Washington Post reporter in China. And one of the great attractions was that the Post reporter in China then, in Hong Kong, was Stanley Carno, who was by far the best of all the correspondents there. I thought he was just amazing. Great reporter, great writer. So he was sort of my ideal.
Frank Ching, who'd been born in Hong Kong and had been editing China stories in New York for the New York Times, moved back in 1974. And in late 1975, I arrived to freelance for CBS, having studied Chinese at Yale and visited the country with a left-wing American student group in 1973. Robert Elegant, who'd been following China since the 1950s, still lived in Hong Kong. Like Henry Bradshaw, Elegant's reporting had long angered the Chinese authorities, and both men remained on Beijing's blacklist. Like Joseph Lelyveld, it took help from Henry Kissinger for Elegant to finally get to China.
I didn't get in China till 75 when Kissinger took me, because Kissinger said that he'd asked Joe to give me a visa. I said, Henry, he didn't give me a visa. He said, you get on the list next time I go to China. The Chinese said he can't come. And Kissinger said, you're not going to tell me who's coming in my press party. No Elegant, no Kissinger. So we went in.
A few weeks later, President Gerald Ford arrived. Ron Nessen was Ford's press secretary.
It was a difficult time for China, because Mao Zedong, who was the revolutionary hero and really founder of communist China, was very old and was sick, and other leaders were moving up to fill in the vacuum.
The pomp and pageantry was the same, but in contrast to Nixon's 1972 visit, Ford's trip was characterized by bad feelings and diplomatic missteps, compounded by the president's own inexperience in foreign affairs. Tom Brokaw was then NBC's White House correspondent.
Foreign policy, and especially China, was not exactly what you would call Gerald Ford's strongest suit. So he was kind of being led around by Henry Kissinger, and after about 24 hours in China, we all began to complain because it was kind of one photo op after another. We couldn't tell what was being done.
There was a lot of unhappiness about that. We were just being paraded around, and we didn't know what the president was doing. And we weren't getting very good briefings. They were very, very routine.
There were very tight restrictions, and the Chinese kept total control.
I got arrested because we had at least enough freedom to go wandering off, but we clearly wandered off into an area they didn't want us to wander to. And so some of the local citizens came around, and before I knew it, I was surrounded and we couldn't move, and then a couple of cops came by and they took us back to the station, and we had to wait there for a couple of hours while they made the requisite phone calls, and then we were released.
The Americans were not sure if Ford would see Chairman Mao.
The Chinese would never tell you what the schedule for the next day was, who Ford was going to get to talk to, and especially whether he was going to get to meet Mao Zedong.
Suddenly, on the president's second morning in Beijing, came a summons.
A messenger comes to where the president and his party were staying, and he says, okay, you're meeting Mao Zedong at 11 o'clock this morning, and you can only bring five people with you. And so we went to this meeting, and I was one of the five.
The chairman could no longer control the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. His speech was slurred. His assistant struggled not only to translate, but simply to make sense of his rambling.
Mao was very old and had been sick, was sick. And it what he sounded like to me was something like this. Blah, 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 blah. And then the translator would translate this into beautiful English sentences.
Later, reporters heard that the rambling two-hour conversation had ended with a Ford faux pas.
And at the end of the meeting, Henry Kissinger said to Mao, "This meeting has demonstrated to me, Mr. Chairman, that your time is not yet up, that you will continue to live and lead your people for a long time." And Mao, as I remember, invoked God, saying, "I think my God is getting ready to call me home." And Henry said, "No, no, it's not time for you to go." Ford leaned in at that point and said, "Mr. Chairman, you do whatever you want to do." Henry's always trying to tell other people, "Well, he's talking about dying." At that point. So everybody was trying to get him out of there.
The traveling press corps for the Ford trip had one unusual member, Gary Trudeau, creator of the wildly popular satirical comic strip Doonesbury.
We had all different kinds of people who would travel. I don't recall another cartoonist, but you know, we had columnists and so forth. And as I say, Gary Trudeau, his comics are always focused on you know, current events, let's say. And so it doesn't surprise me that he would have gone on this trip.
Mao's female interpreters, who had so impressed Ron Nessen, became the inspiration for Honey, one of the most famous characters in the Doonesbury strip. Despite U.S. efforts to put a positive spin on the trip, Ford's visit ended with no breakthrough, the two sides unable to agree on how to move forward.
The main essence of the trip was to convey to the Chinese side that President Ford was not going to complete the normalization process until after his re-election, which he was hoping would take place in 1976. This, of course, was a big disappointment for the Chinese because they had been led to believe by President Nixon that he intended to complete the normalization process within his two terms. Of course, he wasn't able to finish his second term, and that's why when President Ford came in. So that the Ford visit to China was a tense one.
A month later, on January 8, 1976, Zhou Enlai died. His passing triggered an outpouring of national grief, compounded by fear that the resurgent radicals around Zhongqing would seize power. Although under attack, Deng Xiaoping was allowed to deliver the eulogy.
I was just starting out as a China watcher, and the death of Zhou Enlai was really the first big story that I'd been involved with at all. By this time, it was possible to watch Canton TV in the cable and wireless building in downtown Hong Kong. You didn't have to go out to the border and set up a TV and an antenna the way journalists had been doing in the previous decade. And so every night at 7 o'clock and the days after Zhou Enlai died, we would go down to the sixth floor of the cable and wireless building and we would watch these extraordinary scenes of public mourning and the funeral, trying to figure out what was going on. But once the funeral was over, Mao appointed not Deng Xiaoping, but Hua Guofeng, the colorless, politically reliable former party secretary of Hunan province, to succeed Zhou Enlai as premier. And the power struggle continued. A month later, Richard Nixon returned to China at Mao's personal invitation. It was a signal of Chinese impatience with Kissinger and Ford for not moving faster to establish full relations. It was less than 2 years after Nixon had resigned in disgrace because of the Watergate scandal. Gerald Schechter covered Nixon's trip for Time magazine.
It was bizarre in some aspects in that he had his own, we met in Beijing and he had a royal welcome, and then we flew around. It was as if he were back in the White House and Kissinger was still working for him. I mean, it was clearly a Chinese effort to show that they wanted to normalize, that they respected him, he was a friend of China, and forget about Watergate, let's get on with the really important things.
Some members of the press agreed with the Chinese.
This is what he should be remembered for. He's not. He's remembered for Watergate. He should be remembered for China. It changed the world.
Within days of Nixon's departure, the radicals escalated their campaign against Deng. Wall posters appeared on university campuses, denouncing him by name for taking the capitalist road. With political tension growing, on the weekend of the Qingming Festival in early April, when the Chinese honor their dead, huge crowds gathered in Tiananmen Square. They laid wreaths to commemorate Zhou Enlai, but their action was also a clear, although indirect, protest against Zhang Qing and the radicals.
I remember thinking, this is amazing that people would even be able to demonstrate. I mean, it was a very indirect criticism of the Gang of Four, because Zhou Enlai was still officially a revered person. And it was one of those rare situations. He's probably the only case of somebody that actually was able to fall afoul of the Gang of Four and to some extent of Mao, but whose prestige was so enormous that they had to live with him. And they had to live with reverence for him.
Good evening. Tens of thousands of Chinese went on a violent rampage today and rioted in Peking's main Tiananmen Square. Not since the Cultural Revolution 10 years ago has there been such civil disorder in the Chinese capital.
The radicals correctly saw the popular gathering as a threat. On April 5th, they sent in police to remove the wreaths and disperse the crowds. This was an enormously difficult story to cover. I was sitting in Hong Kong trying to call Beijing. It took hours for calls to go through, to get through to foreign embassies and the other small number of foreigners who were in Beijing, most of whom were reluctant to talk. The best information really came from a tiny number of foreign journalists who were based in the Chinese capital. AFP, the French news agency, had a bureau. Reuters had a bureau, and they had reporters in the Chinese capital. But there was no footage, so this was basically a radio story, not a TV story.
We have an eyewitness report from Reuters correspondent Peter Griffiths in Peking and a Washington report from Bernard Kalb, a longtime China hand.
As I entered the square just before dusk, flames burst from the ground floor of a three-story block flanking the square. Masses of chanting demonstrators surged around it, and even while the flames were licking from the ground floor windows, young men higher up were flinging down furniture and sheaves of files into the street. Angry crowds turned away foreigners.
U.S. specialists on China are stunned by the demonstrations. They're using words such as surprising, extraordinary, unprecedented.
There's been a major political shakeup in China.
The next day, Deng Xiaoping was removed from his positions. It was the second time he'd been purged in less than a decade. Later in the spring, Chairman Mao made what turned out to be his last public appearances, greeting the leaders of New Zealand and then Singapore. It was clear Mao would not live much longer.
The reporters intensified preparations to cover his death.
The stories were that Mao was dying, and everyone was sort of on edge, waiting for that, waiting to hear that that was happening.
We had a pretty strong inkling that Mao was failing, and so the New York Times said we need a. The New York Times had a tradition of writing what we call advance obituaries, and for Mao they were really going to do the whole thing. So they thought 4 full pages of the New York Times. It was going to be the longest obituary they had ever written. And they said, we'd like you to do it. And I said, well, it'll take me some time. And they said, well, just do it in your spare time. And I said, there's no way I can do that. I want to go back and read everything I can find and talk to everybody. And so they finally gave me a week. And I wrote 4 full pages of the New York Times with no ads. It's long. It's practically a book-length piece. But I worked day and night on that.
A second strong earthquake today hit densely populated northeast China, apparently causing widespread damage. Like the first one less than 24 hours before, the second one was centered about 100 miles southeast of Peking, near the city of Tangshan, and was felt strongly in the nearby port of Tianjin.
In late July, a huge earthquake devastated the city of Tangshan in northeast China. 250,000 people died.
This was a massive natural disaster, but it was virtually impossible to cover. None of the very few foreign journalists in Beijing were allowed to get anywhere close to Tangshan. Very little information dribbled out. We were reduced to making phone calls to foreigners in Beijing. There was a Canadian student that I had met and become friendly with, and I would call and got some updates about what conditions in Beijing were like, because people there too were out sleeping on the streets, and a few photos came out, but that was about it. We would go every day to the train station in Hong Kong and meet the trains coming across the border from the mainland and asked visiting foreigners, did anybody have a home movie camera? Did anybody take any pictures? But nobody did.
What I remember was Hua Guofeng rejecting offers of aid, things like blankets and things like that. And I remember being very shocked by that, because by then we had a pretty clear sense that it was an immense tragedy and that China was very, very poor and that there were tens of thousands of people out on the streets, and they rejected aid on the sort of ideological grounds that China was self-sufficient.
Traditionally in China, natural disasters have heralded the end of a dynasty. On September 9th, less than 2 months after the Tangshan earthquake, Mao Zedong died.
Good evening. Mao Zedong, the man who for 27 years ruled more than a fifth of the world's population, is dead. The 82-year-old chairman of the Chinese Communist Party died today at 10 minutes after midnight Peking time.
It was a huge story.
In 1976, I take over the Today Show. And Today Show is a little different then than it is now in terms of what we put on the air. And, you know, it was early September. I get a call at 2 in the morning that Mao has died. And we just blew out the Today Show.
The announcement came from Beijing that he had died. And, you know, we started filing radio material. Of course, everything had to be with file footage for TV, because nobody could get into China, and so it was like doing crossword puzzles in the dark.
We didn't know where this was going. You were trying to do the best with informed speculation that you could, but it was, you know, throwing snowballs at the moon.
By sheer coincidence, Time Magazine's Gerald Schechter was in China. He was covering a visit by James Schlesinger, President Ford's former defense secretary.
We're in Tibet, and we all had our oxygen to suck on, and we're late at night. It's September now, towards the time we're getting ready to go back, and we're told that Chairman Mao has died, and they're sending a plane to bring you back to Beijing, and former Defense Secretary Schlesinger is going to be the official American representative at the funeral, and all the members of the party will go to pay their respects with him. We got to Beijing, and as we drove through the city, there were no cars in the streets. But people were in the streets wailing, and it was a tremendous open expression of emotion, and it was as if the head of the family had died. There was this tremendous feeling of being bereft and of not knowing what would happen next.
朋友们,
at the funeral, Hua Guofeng gave the memorial speech in front of a million people in Tiananmen Square. He announced that Mao's body would be preserved and placed in a mausoleum.
CCTV put up a signal for hours and hours of material on the funeral, and they just put this up, and anyone who wanted it could take it down, and that's where we got the images. And everything else we had to do, telephone calls to Beijing if we could get through to somebody, the wire services, Xinhua, it was scraping whatever we could together.
But Schechter was there, the only American correspondent in the receiving line.
At the funeral, we were inserted into the line, mourner's line, and we all met Madame Mao to pay our respects and the other three members. And I looked at them, and I was very moved by the fact that they seemed kind of self-contented that this was the moment they were waiting for. And I went back and I wrote a file about this to New York, and I said just that in the file, that they could hardly wait for the corpse to be buried. The next morning, Schlesinger called me in the hotel and asked if I would come to his room. And I got there, and he said, well, the Chinese have complained bitterly about your copy, in which you said that looked like the Gang of Four was trying to seize power. And he said, I told them that I have no control over you, even though you're a guest here in China. And basically, he made it clear that, it was an embarrassment for him, but that's the American way, and you go and write what you want. And of course, we discussed the fact that since the material had to be filed from the Central Telegraph Office, obviously somebody had taken a copy of my file and sent it to the powers that be, and they responded very quickly with their annoyance.
To Schechter's intense annoyance, however, Time didn't publish his analysis.
Time didn't mention anything about the Gang of Four in the story. And why, I never found out, but they totally edited out the whole question of internal rivalry. And I guess they may have thought it was unseemly to do that since such a historic figure had died.
Time had missed a major scoop, but the magazine did get some exclusive pictures taken by Liu Hongxing, who had been born in Hong Kong to mainland parents but grown up in the U.S. Liu was then a freelance photographer. He managed to get to Guangzhou for Time.
It was very hard to get a visa, but because I was born in Hong Kong, so for Hong Kong people to come into China, you just need the re-entry permit, which I have. I remember very distinctly that instead of seeing the people's face in sadness, what I saw was unusual, extraordinary. I sensed people kind of relieved. Even people were wearing the black armband commemorating, or mourning Mao's death. I saw people doing Tai Chi and so on. I see all the body languages was a sense of relief, and yet it was rather uncertain future.
Indeed, behind the scenes, the power struggle in the leadership was reaching a climax. Zhang Qing and the radicals sought to claim Mao's legacy as their own and schemed to seize total power. But more moderate figures in the leadership enlisted the support of Hua Guofeng and, on October 6th, effectively staged a coup.
The Chinese leadership has given its first indication that there indeed has been a purge of the country's radical faction. Photographs of Mao's widow, Chung Ching, and three other leading radicals reportedly under arrest have been withdrawn from public sale.
We could never have known how fragile the Gang of Four's situation was, and that so quickly after Mao's death, what it was just a month or so, after Mao's death, that that they would be under arrest.
Well, that happened so suddenly. I mean, clearly these people had been wildly unpopular, even though they'd had what amounted to almost absolute power. And when Mao was gone, their big backstage supporter was gone, and that was their fall was precipitous.
The campaign had been conducted mostly by wall posters and demonstrations, as Bruce Dunning reports.
Shanghai, the stronghold of radical Chinese communism, appears to be turning against the four left-wing leaders, including Chairman Mao's widow, Zhang Qing.
The toppling of the Gang of Four triggered an outpouring of public celebration. Unable to get into China, American reporters had to rely on accounts and occasional home movies from travelers.
A Western visitor who took these pictures from a hotel window.
At the same time, Zhang Qing and her followers were the targets of a venomous campaign of character assassination, most notably in a series of prominently displayed cartoon-like posters. And the four were quickly airbrushed out of the official photos of Mao's funeral.
After the overthrow of the Gang of Four, they were cut out of all the tapes at that time. And photographs. And I remember looking and finding a sleeve still on a photograph, like they'd cut out the person, but they had left part of the sleeve there. And they became non-persons.
By the end of 1976, China had settled into an uneasy calm.
1976 was the year of the dragon, and it had been an absolutely unbelievable year. The death of Zhou Enlai, the Tiananmen riot, the purging of Deng Xiaoping, the Tangshan earthquake, the death of Mao, the ouster of the Gang of Four. I think as reporters, as the year came to an end, we were just kind of shell-shocked and trying to take stock, figure out what was going to come next.
凝聚着无尽的哀思，隆重的吊唁仪式将要在这里举行。吊唁大厅的正中悬挂着毛主席巨幅遗像，下面层层排列着松柏长青树万年青。 毛主席的遗体安放在长青的灌木之中，上面覆盖着中国共产党。Thank
you. That was very interesting. With that, why don't I open up the floor to questions? I'm sure many of you have them. I've already had a chance to talk to Mike here at dinner. First of all, in the corner there, please.
Hi. Given your experience, your long experience in China, is Xi Jinping's recent, in your view, Xi Jinping's crackdown on corruption in China, is that truly a corruption or is it a purging? In your view?
I guess when I went to North Korea some years ago, my producer at CNN, after we left, we'd made a number of visits, and we left, he turned to me and he said, well, I'm still confused, but at a higher level. So I have to preface anything I say with the fact that, you know, we still don't know an enormous amount. And one of the ironies of what's happened in China over all these years is that while the country and the society are much more open and much, much more accessible, sort of machinations at the top of the kind that are documented here are still very, very opaque. So there's an awful lot we don't know. That being said, I think Xi Jinping is serious about trying to do something about corruption. I think he recognizes that corruption is a cancer that could threaten the Communist Party's grip on power and ability to run the country. It's also a very convenient tool to take down opponents. I think it's what's striking to me about the campaign is how risky it is, in a sense. I mean, he's really taken on, he's picked fights with an awful lot of people all at once. And I think he has tremendous popular support because people really hate corrupt, sleazy cadres, and to see them getting taken down is popular. But I don't know where this goes or how it ends. I don't know to what extent it's generated so much concern and anxiety and fear within the system. Keith and I were talking about this, you know, the system might seize up to some degree if rich people are afraid to invest because they don't know whether they're going to be a target, and people are, you know, so it's a very fraught period. And there was a piece, I think, in the South China Morning Post the other week in which Xi was quoted as saying this is a life and death struggle. And so this, the implication is that there's concern about some kind of pushback. So it's a very high risk move on his part. And we'll just have to see how it plays out. I don't know if that answers it, but there are just so many unknowns at this point.
Thank you. Next, please. Right here, please.
Thanks, Mark Michelson. Mike, Deng Xiaoping appears, and of course the focus was on the political side. But were there any indications, maybe it's something you can do in retrospect a little bit, that there was anything being considered about economic reform during this time? Not obviously the program that we once saw, but were these issues front and center? Because China was obviously suffering, and I know it was in political turmoil, but were there any indications you can see looking back that maybe, you know, you could see as indicators of what might happen going forward?
Well, I mean, Deng was brought sort of back from political exile in 73, I think, and Zhou Enlai sort of tasked him with trying to stabilize the economy. He was in charge of the economy and foreign affairs. But you had this power struggle that essentially dominated the whole Chinese political landscape. I mean, the first time I went to China, which was in 1973, when I was still a student, there were all these posters. They were having it criticize Lin Biao, criticize Confucius, Pi Lin Pi Kung campaign that was launched by the radicals, that was an indirect attack on Zhou Enlai and therefore on Deng Xiaoping. So you had this incredible sort of ideological pushback, which I think severely constrained Deng's ability to do anything. And then you basically had a whole year, 76, when nothing will happen because this struggle was at its climax, and that just consumed China. So they did nothing on that score.
Next, please. Over in the corner, please.
It was a brilliant piece of journalism. I enjoyed it very much. And China made a huge progress since then. And I have a hypothetical question. With your experience in China, do you think we will see in our lifetime this type of documentaries being accessible in China? Do you think we will see Chinese government maturing enough and being self-confident enough to allow this documentary to be seen by Chinese public or Chinese students or Chinese academic community or whatever?
Well, I've shown this film in China.
Publicly or?
Yeah, university audiences. I guess the other way to phrase it is, could a film like this be shown on Chinese TV? And the answer is obviously not, but I think within the context of I've shown a number of these episodes that go up to the early 1980s in this series. at Chinese universities. But it's very tricky, and it, you know, small audiences, closed doors, not mass dissemination. The room has been greater. I haven't done it in the last year, so we'll see. But I just don't know. I mean, this is one of these, you know, every time you predict something about China, you're wrong. I mean, if somebody in 1986 had predicted, you know, when I moved to Beijing to open the CNN bureau in 87, if somebody had predicted Tiananmen Square, I would have thought they were crazy. A week after Tiananmen Square, if somebody had predicted China Today, I would have thought they were crazy. So I've just learned that I'm glad I don't have to embarrass myself in front of millions of people on TV anymore making these predictions, because it's so hard. But I think, you know, China's like a paradox, and I think this is one of the themes that I keep coming back to as I struggle trying to make sense of it. It's a place that, you know, things happen that are diametrically opposed and contradictory at the same time. I mean, I would argue, even with the crackdown, that ordinary Chinese people have greater personal freedom now than at any time, you know, maybe in the late 80s, but other than that, extraordinary personal freedom, but minimal, if non-existent, political freedom. You know, it's a place where I can show this video, but a Nobel Prize winner goes to jail for writing a petition. So, and it all happens in the same place, and that's one of the things that's hard in getting your head around China, is there's just so many contradictory and paradoxical strands in society all at once. It makes it really hard to sort of figure out and to write about, I think, to cover.
We have one over here, and then Edith, please.
Mitian Yu. It's a related question. To what extent, when you're in China now and you take maybe the average under 40-year-old, are they informed by that period? Are they aware of it? Or are they even interested in that period?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's difficult to generalize. Yeah, history is very problematic in China, and so they go back and forth about how much of what can be discussed about the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. I mean, you talk about people under 40. I mean, they're the generation over 40 lived through the Cultural Revolution. You know, they're sort of hitting their prime now, and so they, you know, for them it's a more sort of vivid memory, although it's, you know, what lessons does one take away from that? I don't know. I mean, Xi Jinping is a good case in point. I mean, his family was victimized. I mean, his mother died, he was sent to the countryside, his father was purged. What lessons does he take away from in terms of how he sees the Chinese system? I don't know. I think for the younger generation, I mean, people, you know, 20s and 30s, grown up, come to adulthood since 89, it must just be, you know, like the ancient history for a lot of them. But, you know, it sort of pops up in odd ways, and it's still not, you know, completely openly or honestly dealt with, so it's still sort of festering there and comes up in various sensitive episodes and moments.
Edith, please.
Hi, Mike, as a journalist and writer, you've had a unique opportunity to study and look at North Korea at a time when the parallels are just all too strong with China in the 1970s. My question is, between 1976 and 1979, attitudes in the U.S. towards China turned around 180 degrees. Maybe that's the next sequence of your series. But how did, you know, I'm just very struck at how that could have happened, and whether, when you look at North Korea, which is equally if not more closed today, whether the media or politicians working on the issue could achieve a similar degree of turnaround?
The answer to the first part of your question is the next episode, which I've shown here, but for those of you who missed it, it's available online, does does look at the sort of the opening up and this astonishing sea change in which the Chinese go from being, you know, the yellow peril to the cuddly communists, it's an amazing phenomenon. I don't really see it happening with North Korea. The circumstances are totally different. The country is much less important and less, it's only important. I mean, to be honest, if North Korea didn't have nuclear weapons, it would be Rwanda, or that's an insult to Rwanda, but you know, it would be some obscure country that the Americans never cared about. It's really, from the American point of view, it's just a sort of security concern. There was a moment when Bill Clinton was president where, had the history unfolded differently, you might have had a Nixon to Beijing episode, because Kim Jong-il invited Clinton in the fall of 2000. Clinton sent Madeleine Albright to lay the groundwork. He was ready to go. And then there was the disputed presidential election, which delayed the outcome for 6 weeks, and then Bush won. Had Gore won that election cleanly that night, I'm convinced Bill Clinton would have gone to Pyongyang before he left office, and the whole history of the last dozen years would be completely different. But it didn't happen. I don't see it happening.
Although Rwanda doesn't have conventional artillery that can level an OECD country's capital.
Not fair to Rwanda, but the point is the Americans, I mean, well, most
Korea would be a terrible threat without nuclear weapons.
But I mean, the lesson to small countries that have contentious relationships with the United States from North Korea is get nukes fast.
Over here, please.
Hi, so I've got two questions for you. The first one is, what do you think are the major impacts and influences of Cultural Revolution in China? I mean, speaking of long term, mm-hmm. and from either a positive perspective or negative side. So the second question is that, do you think the Cultural Revolution is a necessary step for China to make some like democratic reform?
I think the Cultural Revolution was total unnecessary. Self-inflicted disaster. No positive side to it whatsoever. In terms of the impact, I think, there's a whole generation today, you know, in their 40s and 50s who lived through that. It's very, very hard to generalize. I mean, one of the impacts of the Cultural Revolution is that, you know, millions of people in the society lived through this experience where one side was denouncing the other side. People were responsible for imprisoning, torturing, killing other people that in their community, their workspace, and nobody talks about it. I mean, you hear these stories of people in the same work unit walking. Somebody walks down the street past the person who led the group of Red Guards who beat their father to death and stuff like that. So there's this huge internally that people don't express anything. And I don't think that's healthy. I mean, I think it's very hard to come to terms with something that would as cataclysmic as the Cultural Revolution if you can't deal openly about it. And I mean, it was a massive destruction of Chinese cultural heritage. The suffering inflicted on people who had, you know, Western learning or outside contact with the outside world. Was enormous. So there's a very negative legacy which hasn't been fully or openly or honestly addressed, but it's kind of been shunted aside because everybody's looking forward and it's inconvenient and problematic to think about it, so people only in their quietest moments with their closest friends do. Otherwise, it's all looking forward, but I think there's a price to be paid for not coming to terms honestly with something like the Cultural Revolution. But what it is, in what way, hard to say.
Back here, we've got a lot of questions. We'll try to work through. Yes, please.
I'm curious, you touched on the issue of this idea that there's really no collective memory in China. The younger generation really has no idea what Tiananmen was all about. Yet, I follow the foreign ministry briefings, and I'm always struck when I hear them talking about Japan, how Japan has this need to come to terms with history and face up to its role in history. constantly harping on the importance of history at the same time denying history in its own country. Is that just real politics? Is that just pure politics? Is it just Machiavellian politics? Or is there some justification for that disconnect in the Chinese psyche that I just don't recognize?
I think there's some justification for the Chinese being extremely irritated by particularly what Abe has done and his myopia in being honest about World War II. But I also think that the Chinese could make a conscious decision not to respond in the way they do. I read a very interesting, observation that somebody made that in Asian cultures that one of the ways you end up apologizing to somebody is you don't just, go down and apologize. It's like you take them out to a very expensive meal and you make sure you get the check and you give them gifts and it's understood you're saying we're sorry. And Japan sort of did that, with all this aid and investment and so on. But I think also, there are sort of geopolitical reasons as well. But I'm surprised that Abe hasn't turned around and said, this is the pot calling the kettle black here. Because it is. I mean, the irony of Chinese officials saying Japanese have to be honest about their history when the Chinese aren't honest about their history is very striking. There's no question about that.
Back here and then over here, please. Back in the corner there, please.
Mike, fantastic. As a sinologist, having been in China for 34 years, I really appreciate all your insights and taking everything into consideration. I just wonder if you think that the current president is making himself out to be the new Mao. Is he gathering his troops, slaughtering his enemies, which we do see happening? There are many questions I have, but I think this is the big question for you.
Is he a new Mao? My gut feeling is not really. I think, I remember having a conversation with somebody in the middle of 2012, looking at all of the problems that China had, and somebody made the observation that the top leadership knows what the problems are, and they have a pretty good idea of what they have to do to fix them, but the leadership structure that was bequeathed by Deng Xiaoping of this kind of collective leadership and rule by committee and first among equals and the lessening of central power meant that one of the big challenges for the Chinese leadership was if they were ever going to introduce any of the economic reforms that they need over time, how can they do it when the regions don't listen to the center, when there's not a strong person? So to some degree, there may be a consensus at the very top to allow Xi Jinping to become this more powerful person, because without that, they have no chance of ramming these painful controversial steps through. Running China is, I wouldn't want to be Xi Jinping or any of the, it's a nightmare, so it's not that surprising. The debate is how much of this tightening and anti-corruption and repression is qualitatively new and is going to become the new normal as Xi builds himself up. How much of it is, as one cynic describes, signaling left to turn right? That if you're going to make these changes, you want to control, monopolize information, you want to suppress discordant voices, you want to muzzle enemies. The jury's out. I think there are lots of things to be concerned about, but I think you can see from their perspective why there's a certain logic in allowing this person to emerge in this way. But it also carries risks that gets carried away. And in a situation where he's arrogated so much power to himself, who's there who will go and say, oh, Mr. President, this is wrong, we should be doing this differently? Is he getting alternative voices? Is it just living in this bubble where his way is the only way? I don't know, but I think it's much more complicated. And while he gets lots of press and it's all, you know, the Central Committee under Xi Jinping and so on, I don't see it as Mao. At least, you know, you could be laughing at me in 3 years, but I don't right now anyway.
Up here, please. Up here, a second in this row, please.
As somebody who's spent most of their life in Hong Kong, growing up here, remembers watching what was happening in Tiananmen on TV here, I've always been quite fascinated by the relationship between the Hong Kong people and that of their mainland brethren, especially in light of what seems to be happening at the moment. And I just wonder what it was like when you were stationed here in the 70s, what the sentiment was for the local Hong Kong Chinese to what was happening. Were they getting much information themselves here, or was it still fairly independent ideologically to what was happening?
Well, I would say two elements to that. One was China was really very far away. I don't think on a day-to-day basis there was very little back and forth. The idea that Hong Kong might be handed back to China was figment of somebody's imagination. So in one way, it really seemed far, far, far away. I think for local Hong Kong Chinese who had, you know, relatives there, there were letters, there was some travel, and actually that was one of the sources that journalists used. If you knew somebody who had a relative, they would get letters or they would come back and forth. That was one of the ways you could sort of get one of the pieces of a very big jigsaw puzzle. But China really was sort of, you know, it was also, you know, we knew it was like out there, looming out there, but it, you know, it was this, almost this, you know, I mean, I remember going out to Lok Ma Chau or someplace and standing on the hill and peering over or across from Shenzhen, peering over at the rice paddies and wondering what was, because you just couldn't get there. It was just, it really wasn't until the British began negotiating with the Chinese in 78-79 under McLehose that some consciousness that it might be different. It really wasn't front and center.
With that, thank you very much. I guess
one more.
Oh, we got one more over there.
If it's short.
Coming back, a second question. Okay, last
short.
Question. Just a short question.
This is a very short question. What does the China dream mean to you? Because it's all the talk about China dream.
Zhongguo.
Yeah. There's a 50-50 chance it could go either way. I have no idea. It's very hard to say. It's very hard to say, and it's certainly not in a short.
You probably have no shortage of practically everything from the front desk here, but here's another one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. Let me remind you that there are DVDs here for those of you who might want to show this to your friends. And for those of you who haven't signed up for our events yet, again, we have senior economic planner, the top economic planner of Guangdong, coming here next week to talk about the economy. And also Hong Kong's legal system, is it any better than the mainland's? Thank you all.